gentlemen, to another edition of Liberty Unbridled. I'm your host, Ken Molman, and we've got quite a bit to go over tonight. We're going to have David Adams joining us in the second half hour to talk about Obamacare. Before that, we have a slew of things to go over here. And if you'd like to call in about anything we talk about tonight, please feel free to do so. The number here is area code 858-683-1326. Again, 858-683-1326. So let's get this started here. We start off with a bit of bad news. Norm Davis, who has been around Kentucky politics for some time, has been involved with Take Cat Back Kentucky, and prior to that, Kentuckians for the Right to Bear Arms. Norm passed away on Monday. He'd been fighting cancer for some time, and unfortunately, he did pass away. His services were earlier this week. And before I get into that, Norm was very, very influential as far as a citizen goes. He was able to create a network using Take Back Kentucky to be able to flood the state house with green slips. Now, green slips are, you call the state house and you say, I'd like to leave a message for my house member, my Senate member, all the house members, all the Senate members, all the people of this committee, whatever it is, this select group. And they would tell you, okay, what's your message? And they write it down, and they would send that off to the particular legislators. And more than anything, that's what the folks in Frankfurt actually listen to. You can send them emails to your blue in the face. They don't really pay a lot of attention to their email. A lot of the folks in the Kentucky House and Kentucky Senate are of a generation that did not use computers originally and have not really picked up on it. What really matters is those green slips. And so Norm, through Take Back Kentucky and that group, was able to kind of perfect the art of putting all of that together to get folks to call in en masse about a bill and either get something pushed through with popular support or crushed with popular support, one or the other. And that was kind of what Norm did with Take Back Kentucky. And it was also, here in more recent times, when the Tea Parties rose up, kind of a clearinghouse for various liberty groups, some of the Tea Parties in the state, not all of them, but some. And it was a pretty significant group. I mean, again, they did a lot. Prior to Take Back, he also worked with a group called Kentuckians for the Right to Bear Arms. And if you are a concealed carry permit holder in this state, by the fact that you can carry concealed, the Norm is one of the major players that made that happen. And, that's a very big thing. And then also here more recently with industrial hemp, Take Back has been on the industrial hemp issue for quite some time and has been responsible for helping to push that forward. With Norm passing away, which is very unfortunate. I've given my condolences to the family and I'll continue to do so. But the point is that others will continue his legacy. We will continue to push for things like industrial hemp and whatnot. And, he and Gatewood Galbraith, who passed away just about a year ago now, just over a year ago, they worked together on industrial hemp. They worked together on a few things like that. It's a funny thing. Take Back Kentucky, especially, it was a very nonpartisan organization. They worked with people across the board. They worked with people, Republicans, Democrats, elected to office. They weren't afraid to take a stand and did so when they endorsed my campaign in 2011 as a libertarian. And I will always be appreciative of that and very, very thankful that they were willing to take that stand, despite the fact that my odds were obviously long. And, as it turns out, obviously I did not win, which when you're outspent 200-1, that happens. So I did go to that. You know, it was a big event. You know, obviously Norm knew a lot of people, and so they held two viewings, which was very nice. I'm so grateful that they did, because I would not have been able to go to the funeral as it was scheduled, but I was able to go to the viewing the night before, and so I was very, very happy that I did get to do that. I was glad that, for, I won't say happy, but appreciative that his family provided that opportunity. And I did get to meet two of his sons and his wife, who I had never met. And that's kind of an interesting thing. You know, you work with these folks in the Liberty community, you can work with them for years, as I did with Take Back. I think I met Norm originally in 2007 at the Gun Rights Policy Conference up in the Drawbridge Inn. I think it was 2007, I think. And, you know, that's where I met him first, and, you know, worked with Norm on things and helped spread the word on bills that overlapped our purposes in the Libertarian Party. And you know, I knew Norm pretty well, but never really met his family or any of the non-political friends. And so that was kind of an interesting thing to meet those folks. And I always hate meeting them on those circumstances, but, you know, he will be missed, and his legacy will live on, though. He started something great with Take Back Kentucky, and I don't suspect that that's going anywhere anytime soon. So switching gears here, we have some activism stuff to note here. We have there is a Gatewood Galbraith Memorial, or excuse me, Medical Marijuana Memorial Act. For those that are not familiar with that, it is Senate Bill 11. It has been sponsored by Perry Clark. He is a senator from Louisville. He won re-election in a hotly contested race. It was a interesting one to watch. I know both Perry and Chris Tiedemann, and that was kind of excruciating to watch those guys duke it out. But Perry Clark did survive his challenge, and has again re-sponsored the medical marijuana legalization bill here in the state of Kentucky. You know, and we've talked about this in one of the early shows. We had a conversation about the differences between hemp and medical marijuana and full-blown legalization and what all the different nuances are and whatnot. But my personal feeling, you know, obviously I lean towards the liberty side and you know, let what people are going to do, let them do. But when, especially when it comes to the medical side of things, it seems like we should have the, I don't know what the right word is, we should let doctors and patients make decisions for patients, and not bureaucrats, not society, not, you know, different outside forces with no vested interest in the health of a patient. I really believe that that's one that, you know, doctors and patients should be discussing such things and making that determination. And are there abuses? Of course there are. I mean, we see that with the pain pill issues. They're out there. But you can't penalize those that are doing the right thing because of folks that are doing the wrong thing. You know, it's not fair. It's not right. And, you know, there are lots of things about marijuana that are, at a minimum, therapeutic for people suffering from certain ailments. And there's a growing body of evidence that there actually may be some real medical benefit to THC, which is the intoxicating substance in marijuana, that can help with a number of diseases. And so, you know, again, just leave it to the doctors and the patients to decide this. We don't need the government in the middle of this mix, and I think that that's an appropriate bill. 18 states and the Washington, and Washington D.C. Have legalized marijuana for medicinal use in the United States, and I think that's a very good thing. And I think the overall direction of the country is that way. I think that you know, Obama in 2008 made a promise to stop the crackdown on the dispensaries in states that were that had legalized marijuana in those states. And unfortunately, that promise has not come true, but I do believe that that's partially what propelled his win in 2008. Or if it didn't propel his win, it obviously didn't hurt him because he won, and then he won re-election as well. So and just like Perry Clark, Senator Clark, you know, ran on it. He admitted that he has used marijuana in the past. I think the attitude in general society has changed. I'll note it here again just because people always ask if I don't. I have never used it. I don't have any plans to use it. You know, it's not my thing, and so be it. But, you know, especially if it's for a doctor patient issue, you know, that it's for a patient, a doctor believes that it can be therapeutic, it could be pain relieving, it could do something. Certainly, I think everyone who has an ounce of common sense recognizes that these pills they give that are, you know, derivatives of opium are far, far, far more damaging than anything that marijuana could ever be even turned into. So, you know, let's inject some common sense into our policies. Let's, you know, get the government out of the way between patients and, you know, the boy, I'm having a hard time tonight, folks, and I apologize. But get the patients out of the get them out of the equation. So, all right. So, folks, I need to take a quick break here. I just had a minor malfunction. We're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll continue. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters Radio Network.
Okay. Yeah.
Folks, we're back here on Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters Radio Network. Folks, I apologize. We're in a bit of a phase of transition here at the show with locations and whatnot, and so things are not quite right. But hopefully I'm coming through loud and clear now, and hopefully you guys are give me a little bit of patience or your patience appreciated while I get this sorted out. So getting back to this here, because we've got a guest at the bottom of the hour and we need to get through a few of these things, gun control. Definitely a big topic nationally. We have a lot of stuff back and forth. Obama's kind of come out on both sides of the issue, basically saying that both sides need to approach this with a little bit more, I guess I'll use the word sanity, but really a more moderation is really probably the better word, that the pro-gun side needs to come towards the anti-gun side, but the anti-gun side also needs to listen and come toward the pro-gun side. And very interesting to kind of watch this all come together. But the short version of the story is, as a result of all of this, and everybody, you know, kind of sees where this is going, and there was a bill sponsored that bans, it goes even beyond the 94 ban that expired in 04. As a result, there's been a number of rallies planned around the country, and the one locally, I think there's one in Frankfort coming up, but the one I've been told about is in Lexington on Friday, February 8th from 5 to 6:15 in Triangle Park. I believe this is an impromptu rally. I don't think there's been any sort of real planning or anything behind this. But, you know, if you go to that, please be respectful. Please, you know, don't cause any problems. We want people to see the good side of gun owners. And additionally, if you are against gun ownership, you know, we do have people that listen to the show that are against it. I would ask that, you know, rather than being annoying and shouting and all that stuff, you know, save it for your own rally. And, you know, at some point, let's have a rational debate, and that's fine. Debate and discourse is what you have on these. Now, the pro-gun side has the advantage in this argument, and I think everybody, for the most part, agrees, except those who pretend that it doesn't exist, and that's the Second Amendment. Definitely helps the pro-firearm side, pro-gun side in this fight. And being pro-gun myself, you know, I'm not a gun nut. I'm not one that, you know, has a small arsenal buried in the backyard or anything. But I firmly believe in the right to carry firearms for the purposes of personal protection of your property and yourself. And I do believe that everyone who takes advantage of that right should take it upon themselves to be properly trained on that firearm, to be able to properly discharge and use that firearm. And I believe that's a personal responsibility thing. I think that that's something that, you know, really can't be legislated, but I certainly believe that it is the right thing of all gun owners to be proficient with their firearms so as to prevent any unnecessary harm if the need arose to use that firearm, you know, that there's no, as they say, collateral damage. I think that that's a wise, prudent thing to do. I don't want, nobody wants to see innocent bystanders get hurt. So that's kind of where I stand on that. And, you know, but again, I'm not looking for a law there. I'm just asking the people, you know, please be responsible, take responsibility for yourself. And, you know, it's going to help you anyway. I mean, if you're not proficient with your firearm, then it's really not going to help you very much when you need it because you're not proficient with it. And, well, that's what good is that going to do if you don't know how to use it? It's like, oh, I need to drive somewhere, but I don't know how to drive a car. But I have a car, but I don't know how to drive a car. Now, obviously, there's no fundamental Second Amendment right or any Bill of Rights amendment to driving, but the point is that if you are serious about using that right for that purpose, then you have the personal responsibility, in my opinion, to be proficient with that right. So, moving on to other news, the debt ceiling. Republicans have apparently capitulated, and they have put off the debt ceiling talks until May. And apparently, as part of this, the debt ceiling just doesn't exist right now through May. And as a result, I firmly believe that what's going to happen here is we're going to see an unprecedented level of spending that will basically be the rest of the year's level of spending. There's going to be a number of things that get snuck through. I'm sure we'll find out about them, you know, a day late and a buck short, like usual, when things fly under the radar, as they do. I think that I really think this hurts the Republican Party very, very badly. I told a Tea Party group on a different topic, but I was talking to a Tea Party group here earlier this week and talked to them about how Republicans are losing their credibility because they keep capitulating on every issue. And it was part of a broader conversation about how they need to not be tied to the Republican Party. It discredits them to be so. And the point being that the Republicans have totally and completely ceded faith thing having to do with fiscal responsibility. They're done with it. I mean, as a party. Now, obviously, individual members are standing their ground. And, in fact, I seem to recall during some of the previous fights that there were even some Liberal Democrats that were involved in standing up against the run of spending. That, you know, the idea that we can just spend and not worry about it, that's not really reality. Reality for any individual, and it's not reality for our government. And I think that this uncapping of the debt ceiling is a horrible, horrible thing. I suspect that, like I said, we're going to have runaway spending. And when it comes down to it in May, so basically what they're doing is they've uncapped it. When conversation starts in May, I'm sure there'll be a cap that is set that's a little bit higher than whatever the current debt is. Right, because we don't want to start out at a cap, because then we've got an emergency again. So it'll be higher than the current cap. It'll be higher than the current debt at that time. And I suspect that what will happen is we're going to end up in yet another scenario where everyone, the Republicans capitulate, Democrats go along, and we, you know, with few exceptions on both sides, and we end up with a higher debt ceiling. And we'll continue to see the unprecedented spending, the out-of-control spending that's going to eventually bankrupt the country. And supposedly, you know, all this is done to keep the country from having a lower credit rating. But, you know, part of a credit rating in general is what is your debt-to-income ratio. And when you're racking up $3 trillion in debt every year, you know, that's pretty significant. And, you know, we're getting to the point, or I think we've actually crossed the point, where our debt exceeds our GDP, which is basically the value of our country. It's the value of our economy. Our annual GDP, if I remember correctly, is about $15 trillion, and I believe we're over $16 trillion now in debt. So I had looked it up, but my internet's a little bit wonky tonight, so I apologize. But the point is that that's what you're going to be looking at. I mean, if you had a household, and your household made $50,000 a year, and you owed over $50,000 in debt, you're going to have a very bad credit rating. I mean, that's just how that works. And likewise, we're getting to a point now, I really believe that the only reason that we have the credit rating as high as we do for the country is that the last time there was a downgrade was when the S&P 500 downgraded the country. And the feds went after them, you know, basically an intimidation thing to say, well, how dare you lower the credit rating? Well, I mean, they did it based on facts. It had nothing to do with, you know, an administration or politics or any of that. But, you know, using the intimidation of government, they've managed to make it so that others are not going to dare to lower the credit rating. Lower credit rating. So that's the debt ceiling. And now there's also been talk, you know, rolling back to the previous point on gun control, that Republicans may end up supporting, at least some moderate Republicans may end up supporting this universal background check stuff, and possibly the waiting period stuff, and you know, oh, well, we're not going to support registration, but just, you know, mandatory background checks for everybody. Well, I mean, if you have to put all the information in there, as someone who personally works in the storage and backup, I mean, that's what I do in IT, storage and backup. Nobody throws any data away ever, 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 ever. I mean, it's a bad idea both for businesses individually and for government to throw data away. And the reason for that can be legitimate, you know. Say, for instance, we have universal background checks. No registration, but universal background checks. And you apply for your universal background check, and you get denied. Well, there has to be a means by which to appeal that, right? There's going to have to be a way to appeal their decision. And in part of that, part of the proceeding is going to be, well, this is the application that you submitted, Mr. Jones. You know, this is why these, you know, somewhere a court's going to have to decide, okay, Mr. Jones put in this application. Well, if they don't have that information on file, if they haven't kept it somewhere, then the government has no case at that point for keeping a firearm out of someone's hand. So is why they will keep firearms, these universal background checks, if they were to be legislated, they would keep that information forever. And then it's only a small matter of time before the FBI or some other agency goes to a court or goes to Congress and says, hey, we want to have the right to, or the ability to go through any record, and they've already passed a lot of this stuff where they have the right to go through, or the ability, I keep using the word right, that's the wrong thing to use. They have the ability to go through all of these documents, all of these records, all of these things that, you know, they're supposed to be kept separate. They're supposed to be not, you know, there's supposed to be protections against this stuff, and the government's moving the other way, and they're consolidating all this data into one massive thing, and they're building profiles on people based on different data points. And this is all stuff that I do in my personal field in the storage and backup arena about how do you cross-reference and how do you put all this together. It's happening. And that's why you have to oppose the universal background checks too. Or you have to create a universal background check, something that says, you know, we're going to, you know, government is required to destroy any information after X number of days, whatever that X number of days is, and that the information cannot be collated, used, or cross-referenced in any way, shape, or form with any other agency, blah, 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 right? That, basically making it so that information can't be spread out amongst other agencies. But the chances are good that that's not going to happen, that that's not what's really going to happen. If they pass universal background checks, they'll say, well, we need to be able to do anything. You know, we need to be able to cross-reference that because that's part of the background check. And you know what? They may not keep a database per se, but that universal background check, the fact that it's been done, right? Let's say, what's a good example? Say it searches the FBI database, you know, for misdemeanors or felonies on a person. Well, there's nothing that stops the FBI from flagging that, hey, such and such system here in such and such county, Kentucky, or wherever, came in and asked us, did a background check for firearms background check. Well, it's a pretty good assumption that if there's something in their database that says, hey, on this date, this sheriff's office in Kentucky reached out and looked for a background check on this dude, it's 99% or higher chance that it was done because of a universal background check. So it's marked in a database somewhere that, hey, this guy was looking to buy a gun. And that's the problem with universal background checks, because it's the same thing as registration based in the modern era of how all this works. And I don't even think most of the legislators even understand this, and that's a dirty little secret that's not really so secret if you pay attention. Most of these legislators do not have a background in information many, many things that they end up voting on. They don't have a background in it. Many of them just vote based on what the party tells them to vote. But that's why it's so dangerous and why we have to stop this registration push, and that's why we have to hold politicians accountable. And bringing this back to the debt ceiling topic that kind of got me off on that rant, the debt ceiling cannot be allowed to just grow uncontrolled. There has to be a means of telling the government, you're out of money, you're out of credit, you're going to have to make cuts other places if you want to implement this new program. Because cuts are always painful. There's always somebody's toes that are stepped on when you cut something. I mean, it's just the way it is. If I'm trying to give a very good real-life example, but if I've got $10, I'm going to give that $10 away. And I say, hey, anybody who comes to me in the next 3 minutes, you can get this $10. And so somebody walks up right away. But I say, wait, you know, we got to wait the full 3 minutes, whatever. And right at the last second, somebody comes in and says, I want some money too. and you each end up getting five instead, right? But that first person's like, man, I stood here for 3 minutes. I was here way longer. I should have got $10. I should have got the whole thing. This guy shouldn't have got anything. Or he should have got less or whatever. And so the first person that was there gets angry. And that's exactly kind of what happens here when you try to cut one person's budget, the guy that was there first, to give money to some other project, the guy that got there, in the eyes of at least the first person, last minute. And that's what's hard about it. But that's the harsh reality of what we have to do. We have to be able to control what's going on in Frankfurt, but also in D.C. And there's been talk of a new balanced budget amendment. Oh, that's great. Just make sure it's not like the one we have here in Kentucky, where a judge ruled that as long as the checks don't bounce, we're balanced. Doesn't matter how much debt we have. That's silly. You're going to have to put some teeth on that if you're going to actually do that. And, you know, putting teeth on it to make it hard, really hard. You know, we're still locked up over in Afghanistan, police. We're still dorking around over there over 10 years later. And, you know, as a result, that there's a lot of money that's tied up there, you know, and are you going to be willing to say, sorry, Defense Department, you're going to have to scale back your operations? And for many people, that's a deal breaker. There are many people on Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, that, you know, they're getting new, more benefits every day. You know, Bush passed Medicare Part D. And, you know, that's really what's driving that out of control is Medicare Part D, prescription drugs. Are you going to be willing, is a politician going to be willing to say, sorry, old folks, you don't get any money. Your benefits are going to get cut. You know, we told you we're going to get 10, but you're only going to get 5. Well, guess who votes the most? Old folks. So that's not going to happen. The point is that there has to be a legal hard cap in order for there to be true reform. And we're going to need probably a balanced budget amendment to force the legislators to make those tough decisions, to stop creating new programs that, for the most part, are unnecessary because it would require cutting the budget of existing programs. And even then, we're going to have to cut the budget of existing programs if we're going to try to balance, because we just got too much dang money that we're bleeding. Anyway, all right, folks, well, listen, we're past the bottom of the hour. I'm going to take a break here. When we come back, we'll have David Adams, who has been around in politics here and made a name for himself doing various things. But we're going to have him come on and talk about Obamacare, and specifically Obamacare here in Kentucky and what's going on with it. And we'll get an update. They had a rally here recently, so we'll find out what's going on. Thank you all for tuning in. We'll be back here in just a few minutes. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network.
Complex hybrid dialect now. Detect the mesh of many elements compressed down. The melting pot of a super futuristic style. The combination of a vocal caress with lungs that gasp for breath from emotional stress. The special effects in a distorted collage carefully lies between beats of a rhythmic mirage. It's going down. The logical progression on the timeline. The separation narrowed down to a fine line. Kick blur the edges so they blend together properly. Take you on an audible odyssey now. It's going down.
Put it out for the world to see. LP and X-Men did the 10th. When we melt down the wax from your rescue creek,
it's going down.
Put it out for the world to see. LP and X-Men did the 10th degree.
It's going down.
Nobody in the world to see. When we melt down the wax from your rescue creek,
it's going down.
Once again, it is composed sentences altogether venomous. The four elements of natural force.
body on board as we blend the sword with the pen. The mightiest of weapons, swinging might for the chin to elevate mental space, long gone with the wind to defend men from shoddy imitation. Pretend it's going down, style assimilation readily trekking through the weaponry of a pure pedigree, cleverly seeing through whatever is ahead of me, whatever the weather be. Reinventing steadily, it's going down, subterrestrial hot. Rhyme regiment is calling shots. Execution of collaborative plots, ready to bring the separation of style to a stop. It's going down, a logical progression on the timeline. The separation narrowed down to a fine line to blur the edges so they blend together properly, taking one another out of a lot of scene. Now it's going down,
put it out for the world to see. LP and X-Men, grid the 10-3.
It's going down,
nobody in the world is safe when we melt down the wax in your record screen.
It's going down,
put it out for the world to see. LP and X-Men, grid the 10-3.
It's going down,
nobody in the world is safe when we melt down the wax in your record screen.
X-Men, about to blast off worldwide.
And we are back. You are listening to Liberty on Bright on the Live View Matters Radio Network. Actually, I need to take care of some business here real quick because I always do that at the bottom of the hour. If you'd like to advertise on this or any of the other My View Matters Radio Network shows, you can do so by emailing myviewmatters@aol.com. The rates are very, very reasonable. We reach thousands of people a week. It's definitely worth advertising, and it helps keep the show on the air and the other shows on the network. So, with that done, I'm going to bring our guest today. We've only got about 21 minutes left, so I want to bring him in right away. David Adams is a Tea Party activist. He was involved in Rand Paul's primary campaign. He's been involved in some other campaigns. He's kind of got a pulse on a number of issues. And today the main reason we brought him in is that we want to talk about Obamacare. And he's been following Obamacare here in Kentucky. And with no further ado, welcome David Adams.
Hey, Ken. Glad to be with you.
Well, David, you just recently had a rally down in Frankfort. Unfortunately, I could not go, but I want to get an update on what went on at the rally. Are we getting anywhere? What's going on?
You know, the biggest thing that I hear from conservative, right-leaning people around the state is, oh, doggone it, the Obamacare fight is over. We lost. There's nothing we can do. And that couldn't be further from the truth. That was the reason for the Capitol Rotunda rally that we had. That's the main thing driving me now is primarily telling people we need to keep fighting. We need to stay engaged, because if you look at this on a 50-state basis, the Obamacare issue is, or the effort to enact the law is not going very well for them at all. And Kentucky is one of just 13 states that have gone pretty much whole hog for it, which should tell you something, that they're doing an analysis. You know, it's not just Republican states. There are Republican and Democratic states that are taking a good hard look at this and realizing it may not be a very good idea. And in fact, you know, it's a horrible idea. But the legislative effort has been advanced and is advancing still, and so I've got some details on that I figured you'd be interested in.
Yeah, what kind of spawned my curiosity on this issue again is that here in the past week or so, I went to a meeting of a small business association up here in northern Kentucky, and they went into how Obamacare affects small businesses. And, you know, that's actually a very tricky area because there's that 50-employee thing, but it's not really 50 employees. It's 1,500 work hours per week, and it's really confusing. And a big part of this is, exactly as you said, this thing's being enacted very poorly. You know, the whole we have to pass it to see what's in it is pretty much true. Nobody really knew what the heck was in this thing. And as a result...
It's gone on, if I may, it's gone on and on because much of the language in the law itself says, you know, stay tuned for details on this. It's whatever HHS says. And so the regulations that have been issued after the fact, it continues to be that nightmare scenario of Nancy Pelosi. We have to pass it to see what's in it. Well, now we have to wait and see for the latest regulations to see what's in that.
Right. And so there's been shifting regulations, and that was one of the big complaints, is that, you know, it'd be one thing if we kind of knew what was coming down the pipeline, but we have no idea. You know, one big thing for me personally is that it's basically at the end of this year, we're going to see the end of the health savings accounts, and primarily because of the end of the high deductible health plans. You know, I started getting involved in the HSA stuff, what's that been, 5, 6, 7 years ago? They were brand new. And saw what the purpose was. It was to make it so that I was personally invested in my health decisions and, you know, made it so that I had control over it. And with the long-term goal of building that nest egg of money set aside for health coverage, that I could continue to increase the annual deductible on my plan, thus reducing the amount of money I'm paying the insurance company, and instead putting this nest egg over on the side of just-in-case money for health problems. And
you turned yourself into a consumer rather than a widget, and that's what they're doing with this increased government role in healthcare, is they're turning consumers into widgets.
Yes. Yeah, and you know, of course, you know, every time, and David, I know you believe this too, you know, when government gets involved, it tends to be worse than when it started.
Sure.
You know, our healthcare system has continually gotten worse over the years as health insurer, or as the government has continued to butt its nose in. And, you know, a big part of this has been a lack of competition here in Kentucky. They tried to dork around with our healthcare back in the mid-90s and ran everybody but basically two companies out of Kentucky, which jacked our rates up phenomenally high because there was no competition. And then, you know, nationwide before that, you know, it's funny, when they were working on passing this bill for years prior, they used to demonize HMOs. And, oh, my gosh, HMOs were horrible. Well, HMOs were a creation of Congress. They created the HMOs. And it's like, well, wait a second, now you're demonizing the thing you created to fix the problem that didn't fix the problem, or the problem you perceived at the time. And so they end up creating all these other things. And essentially what came out of this entire conversation that was had with the small business owners, you know, there's nonsensical things about how if you have an employee with – the employers will get fined if they don't provide insurance – for certain employees, but if you have certain employees with certain disabilities, they're better off going through the state exchange rather than going through the company because of the way the financials work out. But if you do that, then you have to pay an extra penalty because that one particular employee isn't getting insurance, and so then it makes no sense for the entire company to provide insurance, and so then it becomes just something where the companies are just paying a tax to the feds, and people are getting their health insurance through the state, with the major problem being that they're not bringing in enough money at the state level to pay for all of this stuff. And what it boiled down to, or what was surmised, is that this is meant to intentionally crash the insurance industry and move the country into a single-payer system. And that's really what this was all about all along, that the left wanted that single-payer system, couldn't get it, so they built something that looked like Romney Care that would eventually self-destruct.
Right. And the employers are figuring out very quickly that they have no role in this, it's going to be so onerous for them to attempt to cover their employees that they're just going to throw their hands up and say, okay, fine me and leave me alone. I'll write you a check. I'd rather write you a check than go through all this rigmarole. And interestingly, you know, we had this lawsuit with Hobby Lobby where they're reportedly being sued or fined by the federal government $1.3 million a day for their lack of compliance with Obamacare. And there's really no, it's very likely that Hobby Lobby eventually is going to wind up winning that.
Yeah.
There's not a collection mechanism in place that really works for the federal government. The fighting back, the effort fighting back against this is where the money is, so to speak. That's where we're going to win, is continuing to resist, because their whole thing is contingent upon the states and the employers and the consumers just kind of falling into line.
Now, unlike other states, because I know a lot of states are fighting back against this, Kentucky is one of the states that was actually an early adopter, and we got some sort of bonus for that, if I remember correctly, as far as extra money to set up our state exchange. Can you explain a little bit on that front?
Sure. The way that they laid this out, they were really hoping that all the states would set up state exchanges. And so they even wrote it into the law that the only way that consumers could get federal subsidies was if they were purchasing the health insurance through a state-based exchange. That there could be federal exchanges if a state absolutely refused to set up an exchange, but that the consumers could not then gain access to the subsidies, and so that would force the state's hand and force them to go into it. Well, the states are saying, look, we don't want it. Our people don't want it. Just leave us alone. Go ahead and run your federal exchange and forget the subsidies. And that's happened with so many states now that the federal government really didn't want to run an exchange, and they're not prepared to run exchanges. And it looks like they're going to have to run about 36 state exchanges. And so that's a big step toward the whole thing just collapsing. And what happens at that point when the law collapses, again, the left hopes that the people come clamoring and say, look, we hate the insurance companies. We hate the idea of it being run through the states. Just go to single payer. Just handle it for us and take care of us. At that point, you know, as that's starting to happen, the real opportunity for free marketeers is we could perhaps even enact completely a free market system in that chaos, or at least move towards that to some extent. And that's where Senate Bill 3 comes in the Kentucky legislature. It would expand a loophole in Obamacare for religious health sharing. And it looks like the fact that the Senate has bumped that up to Senate Bill 3, it was initially Senate Bill 16, that speaks to the fact that they're making it a pretty high priority. It's now the highest numbered bill in the Senate. So it's presently their very top priority. So I expect that to sail through the Senate. A discharge petition could get that a floor vote in the House, and I think, and perhaps it may even not need that. It may just get a floor vote in the House because it actually doesn't contradict Obamacare. It works hand in hand with Obamacare and just expands the rights of Christians. And to the extent that Kentucky's 2 million active Christians would get even just a little bit involved, that would push that tremendously. There's also Senate Bill 39, which would require the state government to get permission from the legislature to do the Medicaid expansion, which is part of Obamacare and optional to the states. Senate Bill 40 would require the state government to get the permission of the legislature to join the to actually join the health insurance exchange and do the state-based health insurance exchange. So those again will be very easy to get through the Senate. Perhaps will require a discharge petition in the House, but then I think will be very hard for even House Democrats to vote against.
Well, that's now the loophole that you had mentioned. Now that would be for any religious organization, right? So if there were a Hindu population in the state of Kentucky, they'd be able to, you know, create such a loophole as well.
That's a good question, and actually, unfortunately, the way that the law is written, it's just there are only three religious health sharing organizations that are grandfathered in, and they're all three Christian organizations.
Okay.
Now, I have a meeting in the morning with my congressman, Andy Barr, going to present to him a way to introduce legislation that would do away with the grandfather clause and would allow new religious organizations to come in, and that's where it could be Hindus, it could be atheists, it could be anything,
right?
And that's what we need to have anyway. We need to open the marketplace up in any way that we possibly can for new entrants and a free market model, and this would take care of it in a big way. So Senate Bill 3 in Kentucky, and then stay tuned from Congressman Andy Barr for federal legislation expanding religious health sharing in the Obamacare bill. And in my view, that opens the door for taking care of the whole problem.
I'd be very interested to see if they can do something, you know, if you're talking to them anyway. See if there's something they can do to save my HDHP. I mean, this is crazy. You know, I've got more money in my HSA than – actually, it's double – my deductible at the moment. I was supposed to be going up to the next plan up and saving even more money. And, you know, it's fairly frustrating that, you know, and on top of all of it, that really frustrated me, part of the law made it so that withdrawing the money from the HSA for non-medical purposes used to carry a 10% penalty on top of the taxes you had to pay because that money was pulled out tax-free. But now it's 20%. So basically now, you know, the effective tax rate on that is anywhere from 35% to 50%, depending on how much money you make. And that's crazy. I mean, you know, you changed the law. You made it so what I was doing is not legal anymore. Okay, fine. But you're also going to penalize me again? It's extraordinary.
Retroactive punishment for having a free market health care program.
Yeah. I mean, why? Boy, I was really, you know, being horrible. I tried to take responsibility for my family's health care. You know, that's definitely worthy of a penalty.
My greatest hope in this whole mess is that when we start to clear this up, we start asking the fundamental question, now, why is the government involved in this at all? Well, what solution are they purportedly providing to us, to anyone in this sphere? And the fact is, they don't provide any solutions. All they do is cause problems, so we should systematically get them out of the way. You know, if there are special populations, and there are legitimately special populations that need and frankly deserve special help, and the government can, if they limit it severely, can step in and do some good. You know, a very tiny Medicaid program for very, very poor or disabled people can make a lot of sense. But we keep making Medicaid bigger and bigger and bigger and more of a multi-tentacled leviathan, and then wonder why it doesn't work for anybody. It becomes a disaster. And what we need is government stepping so far back that we can do health sharing programs, we can do health maintenance organizations if people want to. We can do indemnity plans. where you go to any doctor, any hospital, anytime that you want, and they pay the bill after the fact, no questions asked. The high deductible plans, if that's what you want, you know, if you want to work, if you want to have an insurer that excludes people for any number of reasons, you know, let's have one that, you know, I was joking yesterday, I was talking to a group about we could have bald guy health insurance, an insurance sure. company that just insures bald guys. You know, so what? I mean, it's no business of the government to stand in and say, well, you're discriminating against people with hair on top of their head, you know, or of certain races or creeds or sexual orientations. They just need to get out of it, go away, and leave us alone.
Right, and let people set up whatever organization they want and be a part of whatever one they want. It's, you know, like I said, I really believe that this is intentionally broken. I do believe this thing is meant to fail. It's meant to fall down on its face. And, you know, the more people we make aware of that and the more people that realize that this is destined for failure, the louder I think that drumbeat can become for, you know, stopping it before it, the inevitable breakdown occurs. So, well, David, we're about out of time. I certainly appreciate it. Do you have anything else to plug real quick?
Yeah, just to reiterate, call your state representative, your state senator, and tell them to pass Senate Bill 3, Senate Bill 39, Senate Bill 40. We do that, and we're essentially out of Obamacare and on our way towards more of a free market model in the state of Kentucky.
We will certainly post those up on the Facebook page, and certainly appreciate it every time you're on, David. Thank you very much for keeping us in touch on this issue. I don't know that anybody else is really watching this closely, so thank you very much for your time tonight, and we will catch up again with you soon.
Thanks, Ken. Bye.
Thank you. Bye. So, all right, folks, we've got 2 minutes left on the show, and there was one other topic that I wanted to get to tonight. We have a story here, and I had no idea this was happening until it happened. It is now a crime to unlock a cell phone. What does that mean? Cell phone carriers lock phones to their particular network. They'll sell it at a discount, but they always make their money up on the network fees, and that's why they do that. They'll sell you a $400 phone for $200, but they'll lock you into a 2-year contract, and over the course of 2 years, you're going to spend $300 with them. These contracts always contained costs as far as early termination fees and whatnot, and usually involved paying off some portion of the hardware as well. People have abused it in the past. Having worked with a smaller carrier myself, I've seen other people who have bought phones from one carrier, take it somewhere, unlock it, and then put it on their own carrier. The problem is this is going to hurt small carriers, and we're running out of time, and I wish we could have hit this more. But the very short version is, the cool phones from the big manufacturers are going to be locked up by the big cell carriers. You're going to see it even more now. And essentially, at the end of the day, the little guys, what few little guys are left in the cell phone industry, are going to get hurt even more. You're going to see less competition. You're going to see more oligarchical setup for cell phones. And that's bad for consumers. I mean, we've seen here in the past year that the prices have gone up, that unlimited plans have been scaled back to 5 gigabytes a month, which is really not that much in the grander scheme of things. We've seen as competition is waned down to just a few that consumers are no longer getting the full benefit of competition. Folks, we're out of time. Thanks for tuning in again to another edition of Liberty Unbridled. We'll be back here next week, 7 o'clock. Tune in, join us. Thanks for tuning in. Tell your friends, tell your family. Until next time, enjoy your week.